Sam, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. It's really good to be here.
Yeah, of course. Well, I'd love to maybe kick off with a little bit of context. So do you mind maybe sharing a little bit more about kind of your background and how you found your way into the world of cybersecurity?
Wow. Yeah, I'll try to keep it short too. So I've been in the industry something like 3 decades. I found myself into it by accident. I think when it really, like, I had done some Signal stuff and whatnot, but I started with a small, really small company called Signal 9 Solutions out of Ottawa in Canada. And I didn't consider myself a cyber guy, but that, to be fair, we didn't use the term in those days. I was InfoSec, and I started doing documentation, and then that spread to like doing QA and so on, and getting progressively more technical. We got acquired by McAfee. So I moved to San Jose, California. But I think the moment when I felt like a drive was when, so we invented the personal firewall, really. There were no drivers for that. And we thought it was way too technical. We thought people weren't going to use it. And we noticed there were a lot of downloads, and it actually cost $75 in the late 90s. Like, that's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And so we contacted a few people, and we found that people were using them at home, and we're like, how are you doing that? And we contacted them to find out what they wanted, new features and stuff like that. And, you know, this is kind of emotional, but, a mom told us that her son was differently abled and was going to a website in order to learn how to use the internet, and hackers were cutting their teeth by attacking them because they didn't understand what was happening, and they could try with targets that were basically vulnerable, and it was disgusting. So we wound up giving them the product, but it was one of those things that you viscerally feel disgusted at. So when I went to McAfee, I think I'd been there for like 2 years. I was chief security architect, and I ran product for .com, which was the third most successful .com to my amazement. By the time I was there for 2 years, I'm like, hey, wait a minute, I'm an InfoSec guy. Like, how did that happen? And it had happened gradually over 7 years. So by that point.
Got it. Okay. And then as CISO of Zscaler, how did we get there? What was sort of
Not that long ago. So as we're recording this, it's now late October. I actually joined in March of 2023. So pretty recently. But my last job was in the CISO for Cyber Reason, which is an endpoint security player. And I got very frustrated. I used to be, among other things, the CTO at RSA. And I was sitting at a conference in late 2013. It was an IDC conference, and Charles Kalaji was up on stage. He was an analyst, and he did this projection for market size. And it was like, the cyber market's going to be 150 billion by, I forget what the year was, like 2016 or something. And I'm sitting there going, okay, 10 years, we've spent $1 trillion. A trillion. Like, that's with a T. I mean, now it's nothing, right? But that was something then, right? I'm kidding, right? But it was a trillion is a lot of money. And then the next, and by the way, we had just passed storage as a percent of IT. When I joined, you know, InfoSec, it was less than 1% of IT. 8% is what storage had, and we were past that now. And remember, I worked for RSA, the security division of EMC. So, like, this was a big deal from a market perspective. The next person on stage was a CISO who said, and I won't name him, he said, there's those who've been hacked and those who don't know it. My brain had this cognitive dissonance. I'm like, what? Like, $1 trillion? I'm sorry. After $1 trillion, you just have to resign yourself to being hacked. Today. So don't worry, this will come around as Zscaler. So I decided at that point I was only going to make decisions in my life around career and like really a mission that was going to reverse that. And so I thought, well, what's causing it? And it was that we're not innovating fast enough. We're not increasing our proficiency in defense fast enough. So I will choose companies that I go to, you know, boards that I sit on, who I'll advise, not on the basis of like, because I could work anywhere, right? You probably could too, but not on the basis of say revenue, because I can make money in different places, but on who's going to have the biggest effect on that. And Zscaler is one of those places. And so for me, it's how do you change the game so that it's not just the bad guys have to get it right once and get in. How do we make it so that they're scared? I actually coined a new term recently, negative trust. What we want is We want the bad guys to be scared to make a move. We want them to, if they screwed up, or even if they get it right, we catch them. As opposed to the crunchy exterior, and once they're in, and then sitting in an audience and someone goes, "Those who've been hacked and those who don't know it." Like, stop. I don't go to work to do that, right? And I can't be sitting, you know, 10 years in the future is what I told myself, and that's going to be next year. Yeah, late, actually, in another month or two. Wow, it's late 2023. So it'll be another month or two. I was saying to myself, I can't be here in 10 years hearing the same thing in an audience. And we'll see where we're at by the end of the year. Yeah.
One thing.
Was that too wordy? I'm sorry. That was too long-winded, that one.
It wasn't. No, that wasn't at all. There's given me a lot to think about and a few things I'd love to jump into.
Sure.
To one of the first points you made about sort of spend in cyber and the increase in spend in cyber. For me personally, that was one of the things that kind of drew me into this space. I've talked about this before on the show, but my first job out of college was at Gartner.
And right. Sorry, I mentioned Charles Fauci and Chris Christensen was there too, but Gartner has done projections and Forrester and everybody else. Yeah.
Right, exactly. And it was like that actual data point, which kind of jumped out to me. And like Gartner was a great first job out of college because I learned a little bit about a lot of different types of IT. And I had customers that in security and analytics and infrastructure and all these different realms of IT that I had to figure out how to best support them in all these different areas. But the thing that like made security kind of rise to the top and where I you know, started joining product companies in the space was largely because of that I just found really interesting that companies were spending increasingly more on cybersecurity, but the problem wasn't actually getting better. It was measurably getting worse, despite all of this additional investment. So I just found that to be kind of interesting.
I think we have a reason for that, but we have a reason for that, by the way. First of all, I think we lionize certain brands. And people, you know, there's this old saying in marketing, and here's a technologist telling you this, so watch out. is the packaging is the product. It's really hard. It took me a long time to accept this because as an engineer, you're like, yeah, but what is it? Like, what is it? Mm-hmm. I had a product years ago where we made it lighter and we made it, you know, easier to carry. I used to joke, I was a CTO for the world's largest keychain manufacturer, but the price went down when we made it lighter. And then the price went up, as did units sold when we made it heavier. Huh. Perception of quality, right? And so something is a commodity when it's available everywhere and the quality is the same everywhere. So this was the case with antivirus for years. There were actually over, Symantec and McAfee's days dominating the industry. If you look back, there were actually over 30 providers at that time who all from a quality perspective were roughly the same. But you bought... In a world where you were going to get viruses, you bought from the brand and you paid for the brand. And that's basically what you got. Now, so why is it that every year the spend goes up? Well, because we need the brands to be worth more in some ways. That's part of it. Also, the larger companies tend to buy up smaller companies because they're not good at innovating. But we haven't. Yeah, unlike a lot of industries, you look at like ERP or productivity, once the quality is the same everywhere and you only differentiate on price, your price should go down 30% a year. And that's what happens in many, many industries. But those industries, generally speaking, don't have an intelligent opponent adding and requiring you to innovate. And we do. And so if you're standing still as one of those companies, it happened in identity, it happened in threat, it's happened in SIM a few times. If you're standing still and not innovating, then you're waiting for disruption because these smaller companies, so you got to acquire. And if you don't keep up with that acquisition, then you get disruption. So examples of disruptions, Okta and identity, right? Or Ping in its day, in the threat space, someone like a CrowdStrike or SentinelOne, right? In the SIM space, there's the endpoint space. In the SIM space, somebody like, and I'm just naming companies, but somebody like a Palantir or Splunk, right? So what happens is these companies sort of get to a parity and they're not innovating fast enough. They don't buy up the new incumbents. Those incumbents get to a certain critical mass and they're innovating and they just go right past the incumbents and they disrupt the market. But until we actually solve the base problem we started this conversation with, that's going to keep happening.
Yeah. So do you see that as kind of the it's almost like a lack of incentive to innovate for large organizations, or is that like?
Oh no, I don't think it's a lack of incentive. I think the incentive is there. This is this book, the Innovator's Dilemma, and it's super hard in a big company to innovate. So why? Well, when you're actually in a small startup, you're hungry. You're worried about how do I survive? How do I get VC in or investors? How do I get sales up? And how do I innovate and lean ahead of my capabilities and then meet those capabilities, right, when I deliver? So you're living on the knife's edge and you're innovating and the whole company is dedicated to it. By the way, that's actually what the attackers are doing too, in a dark way, right? Mm-hmm. But what do you do in a big company? Well, you do some business planning. It takes a few months. Everyone's getting a paycheck. You know, everyone's got benefits. You're not worried about investment, right? In the market, which is the most cutthroat place, your success rate is actually very low. Okay, so anything a big company does that doesn't even have that degree of pressure, that's well thought out, things are determined by committee, is by nature not going to have the same kind of success rate. But they don't make thousands of bets. They make one or two. Mm-hmm. And so the larger they get, the more driven by risk-averse committees they get. And this is my personal opinion, by the way. Like, right. So what you need in a large company is a desire to take risks, a flat organization, and a guiding principle of what they want to be and do. And a lot of these companies go, no, we're going to have one of everything in cyber. And we'll have committees to minimize risk. And we'll have these groups that take a long time to build things. It's the exact opposite of what the best machine at producing innovation is, the market, which is we're a small group. We do things on the fly. We listen to customers. We iterate quickly. We lean forward. And they have a high failure rate. So what are you going to do when there's like 1,000 companies out there innovating this way and you get a few companies to make it through the end? If you've only got three projects that are slow, you buy companies. And you better be in the buying game unless you fix those. And so the really good companies do things like get into the investment game. You know, they actually bring in innovators. They keep a flat org. They take risks. They encourage the taking of risks. They get outside the building. So you can do it. It's just not as common.
Yeah. No, that's helpful. You helped me form a better question there, because it's what I guess I mean by large companies not having an incentive is it?
Well, they really want to, by the way. I've had CFOs tell me, please don't make me go buy more companies. Like, and I'm like, no, you got to manage a portfolio that you take risks in.
Right.
You have to. Yeah.
Got it. Okay. So it's not that, you know, the market acts as a filter and big companies can just sit back and let the market do its thing and then pick up the winners.
They often do, by the way. You know,
right.
That's de facto. It's not the intent. Yeah.
Yeah. But that shouldn't be the strategy in your point of view. It's they should be open to that, but also internally foster their own innovation and not just rely on startups to pick up for a few hundred million when they hit a certain point.
And I should say that, you know, and not only is this my opinion, it was heavily influenced by the fact that I used to work for Computer Associates, right? And you may not know this, but we used to call it the place where, you know, good companies go to die. That has been given to other companies. But when I joined, they had made 800 acquisitions. 800.
Wow.
Right? And they bought all across the spectrum. It turned out it was a great place for me to work, and it was actually a great company. Today, it's part of Broadcom, I believe most of it is. But it was an acquisition machine, and they had a playbook on how to do that. They would walk in, they knew what they were doing with every asset in the building and every person. But
yeah,
so it winds up that way very often. And I remember having this conversation with a certain large security vendor who, after he sold the company, having this conversation with him about whether or not the security industry was going to survive, because I actually said, hey, there's a barbell effect in cyber. The middle of the market is like this stretch through what World War I we would have called no man's land, but not quite as grim, right? There are large cyber companies, and there are components of these companies that get into bigger companies, like RSA was part of EMC, right? Or there was an identity business within IBM, or an identity business within CA, or Sun, or what have you back in the day. But the middle was this stretched out, attenuated thing where you tried to bolt across it. Companies that did this were like Checkpoint in its day, right? Back then. And so you had this huge number of startups, and you still do, and they get into the 100 million to a billion range, and you start to see them thinning out because they're getting acquired and they're approaching this no man's land. Some of them make it across to that 2 billion mark, and they get a little bit too big to buy in many cases, not always, or they IPO or what have you, and they're off. But that it's not like a lot of other markets where you have this huge, you know, small end of the market, and then you've got these big players, and in the middle, it's really thin.
Yeah.
It's not like other markets like that.
Yeah. One thing, I was talking with Adrian Ludwig like 3 months ago. I don't know if you know him, but he was the CISO of Atlassian.
Yeah.
And we met just after we spoke earlier this summer.
Small community of us, by the way.
Yeah. There's only a handful. And between the two of us, we probably talked to everybody. So, but one thing he mentioned to that last point is his point of view at some point in the future is that security is going to be abstracted away.
That's what's happened.
Yeah.
Over its entire history. Keep going. I want to hear what he said though.
Yeah. And that's kind of the punchline to elaborate on that. It's that it's going to essentially natively be built in to product.
Oh, see, that's different. That's a different state. That's a different statement. So I'm going to give you a fun statement. I used to say this. I used to say security is something that wasn't done right the first time.
Mm-hmm.
The whole malware, anti-malware, is we didn't get the integrity of the file system right to begin with, so a whole industry emerged. Identity. We didn't manage identities correctly, so it emerged. Mm-hmm. Cryptography. We didn't handle the confidentiality and, you know, that side of things correctly, so it emerged. You can go through, say, SIM. We didn't manage the logs correctly, so it emerged. Right. By emerged, I mean it pulled out and became a distinct thing with its own needs and roadmap. And as long as it has its own requirements, it will continue to grow as a market. And when it doesn't, it will then basically collapse back into infrastructure. So all of these spaces are actually abstractions. We have an idea, whether or not we formalized it or integrated or have standards correctly or we federated, whatever it is, each of these subsets of cyber, and they're not really very connected. Each of them is an abstraction of something not done correctly in infrastructure the first time. And to be fair, you couldn't do it because it's much more complex. It's Dunning-Kruger's sort of been disproven, but it's that we underestimated how difficult it would be. And it sort of spun off as its own thing and got bigger and bigger and bigger. And it became a huge thing by itself that really shocked folks. Crypto is one of the first things that went back into the infrastructure, and it may yet reemerge because of things like quantum computing, for instance, right? But crypto went back into things like hardware and the network.
Right.
And it went into storage, for instance. That was the logic behind the RSA acquisition, by the way. It wasn't the identity and the authentication side. And that eventually will all he's right in another sense. So I think it's the abstraction of it pulling out of mm-hmm. the infrastructure that what are we trying to do? We're trying to build systems to have humans and machines do transactions and interact with data. That's what we're trying to do more and more reliably. So when these things aren't done properly, they get a life of their own. And as long as they're differentiating and have their own requirements, that abstraction becomes more formal and larger. And then when they don't, they get sucked right back in. And so he's right in the sense that there are abstractions and that it will eventually go back into infrastructure. The question is when, and it's sort of like the cold energy death of the universe. It is eventually going to happen. It's just not today.
Right.
So the between now and when each of these spaces goes back, there's interesting things that will happen. But if somebody can innovate and force that commoditization, they can totally change the world. So for instance, if somebody could solve that, hey, how do you do integrity for files properly and for parts of things like operating systems and workloads, you could absolutely blow up the endpoint security market. Boom. If you figure out how to do identity correctly so that you get fine-grained authentication and authorization at scale on demand, and that's what I think Zero Trust is a play for, by the way, then it's going to revolutionize identity. But it won't all happen immediately. Revolutions are quick, but they're not instant. I also think that the way that we're going to have to, the way that we're going to change the game, what I started with, is with revolutions like that.
Yeah. Speaking of revolutions, I know you said you coined a new phrase, negative trust.
When I say I coined a new phrase, there's a bit of hubris there, because you don't coin anything unless somebody else picks it up, right? So one of them was negative trust. People started to use it a bit. Another one I did recently was shadow AI. That was kind of, I think that's going to take off, right? We have every now and then you say something and then it kind of dies. And then the marketing department gets it. And then you
have a coin. And all hell breaks loose. Yeah.
Like John Kindervagen, Zero Trust, for instance. Right. And, and that sort of thing. It's not an obvious thing, but sometimes you hear, that sounds kind of cool. And then it either gets amplified naturally or by a marketing budget somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'd love to dig into maybe what you meant by negative trust a little bit in terms of deterrence, and, I guess deterrence is probably the best word, right, for some sort of an adversary. So
that's one of the things you get out of it. So let's start with the case of positive trust, right? Which makes it sound like a good thing. It's not. So, what have we been doing for the last few decades, four or five decades? We've tried to connect as much as possible. And so, like in IT, after you tell people to reboot, you say, can you ping? Can you connect? Metcalfe's law says the more you connect, the more valuable things are. And how do you make sure in IT that you have less tickets that are open for less time? You connect everything. That's a maximum trust world. Maybe we should say maximum trust rather than positive trust. It's the maximum trust world. A zero trust world, or even a zero trust principle, a least function and, least privilege world, is where you try. This is the simplest articulation you'll ever get of it. You only enable what the business requires. That sentence, the tricky word is only, and that's hard. So it's really, what is the least needed for the business functions to happen? And then you tack on things like without affecting or negatively impacting user experience. So what you want to do is have a sort of a just-in-time, access and authorization world where you always verify the trust when you need it in that world. So how you go about doing that, that's debatable. That's what Zscaler does, right? At scale. We have a zero trust exchange. It's kind of like a switchboard for every request. It's uniquely resolved. Okay. So now we've gone from maximum trust to zero trust. What's negative trust? Well, negative trust is the opponent. How do you make it so that when they're on a network, you use things like deception and lures? And how do you do things like give them fake credentials or even fake networks, such that every time they go to reach to use a tool, they're not, now you get what you were talking about, the detente, right? they're scared to touch it. But when they do, there's a very strong chance they get it wrong, and it sends a super signal to the IR team, or, so the signal from noise, right? It's super hard to do, but let's take an example of, let's say they compromise your identity and they're on your laptop. You would never run Lasagna or Mimikatz or Empire on your system. You would never do that, right? As a user, you know your username and password. You would use that. But every hacker is going to do a credential dump, and they should see 100 credentials and go, oof, which one's the real one? And as soon as they use one of the 99 wrong ones, a signal gets sent that has a very high likelihood of being right, of being like true positive, right? That says, hey, this machine, this identity, because it's associated with you, is worth your investigation right now. So then your dwell time gets shrunk down enormously. Same thing's true for files. Same thing's true for networks or servers or workloads. And in fact, we're in a world now where we can make those lures, actually due to LLMs, not forget the AI thing, but LLMs can make them look like we would name them. Right. Because normally if you look at like a bunch of passwords, you're like, okay, the human made that one, and those are machine generated. They don't look like what a human would generate. But now we can get around that. And you can go even further. You can actually, it's sort of like a World of Warcraft or a multiplayer game, right? You only render the space around the avatar. You don't have to render the whole world. As they move, you move the bubble with them. You can do the exact same thing with a hacker and put them into a fake network with fake apps and fake data. And they're exploring this world. And all you got to do is remember what you've generated behind in a minimalist way. Yeah. And guess what? They're off on some tangent being slowed down while you're cutting them off in the real world.
Got it. Okay.
That's negative.
So concept. And I see how that would act as a, you know, a lure and a distraction kind of at its most simple. What do you think about, and I haven't talked about this with anybody, but in terms of like actual negative consequences for that hacker, right? So that they are truly deterred from ever trying again. Is there anything
truly deterred
possible there?
The answer is yes, things are possible, but it's going to take a lot of work to get there. And we also have to ask ourselves the question, do we want that world? Mm-hmm. Because there's trade-offs to be made. I'll get more specific in a second, but first of all, I personally don't believe in hack back, certainly not among companies. Companies should not be police, and we shouldn't be vigilanteing. That's just my opinion. That nation states often do this, and that's okay. That's the prerogative of sovereign states. Sovereign states have a right to defend themselves, and for a bunch of reasons, often extend power. Okay, right? Dime, right? Diplomacy, information warfare, military and economics. That those are the tools of states. Okay, that's going to happen. All right, so now we get to attribution. And attribution, forgive the world, it's almost a fetish. People want to know who has, like they want to know who did this to them. It's the first reaction of the non-technical, and it's that simmering burning of the technical that we still want to know. But that doesn't really help us. It can be abused. It can be used to mislead us. There's false flags. And heaven forbid, if you fire back at the wrong person, wow. I mean, what have you just done, right? I mean, so I'm not a big fan of it. Now, there aren't many treaties that help you do this. Most cyber crimes can fall under existing law. Okay, fine. But down the road, I think we're going to get to a world where sci-fi, the cyber-physical, is going to become more integrated and more forms of intelligence than just cyber, things like geospatial intelligence, mass int, right? Hum int. Those things, if they become much more integrated, we may see a world that becomes, shall we say, better at being able to pinpoint the physicality and how it impacts the digital. We don't have to drive it that way. It's not an inevitability, but it could go that way. And we have to, and I want to see us deal with things like privacy, right? I remember the Clipper debates and I remember the Clipper chip. And I remember it always creeps up. Do we have trusted third parties and who can read encryption and not? And there's those that believe that privacy is a sacred thing. And there's those that believe that safety is a sacred thing. And that debate has been waged for a very long time. And if we don't solve that, it's just going to continue, and we need, and I don't think we're going to solve it, but we need to be very careful what capabilities we build. If we live in a world of attribution followed by hack back.
Yeah.
I don't know if that helps you.
Yeah, no, it sparked another idea, and just sort of trying to remove what I know about cyber and just like think creatively from maybe even an outsider's point of view, and other perspective may help with creative ideas and innovation.
Well, Joe, remember, it's not about can we do it? It's about what do we want and need to do? Because technology is there to serve us. Everybody, you know, I was engaged with a colleague of mine who's trying to really understand zero trust and said, what should I do next? And I said, what does the business need? And it took him aback. And I said, there's like seven things you could do. Are you trying to save money? Are you trying to reduce your tax surface? Are you trying to get a better user experience? If you haven't thought of that, then you're going to a monolithic project instead of digestible steps that the business requires. That's why we're here. So, I had the same conversation, by the way, if you go back in time around NAC, right? Network access control. I was at a show. I swear I didn't mean to embarrass this guy. Someone stood up and said, hey, you know, I have a 30,000 user business, we're a hospital, we're rolling out NAC. It was a Cisco thing. It used to be NAC NAP. NAP was the Microsoft equivalent. And so what should I do first? I said, well, okay, well, why are you doing it? And I swear I wasn't trying to embarrass him. He stood there and said, had no answer in a room full of like 500 people. I was on the panel. I'm like, ooh, I felt so bad. I'm like, is it because you're trying to like lower risk or something? And like, he just froze. And yeah. It was one of those moments where like, I wish I could rewind the clock and say, let's talk after or something, you know, like, but because there isn't one answer. And so the same thing is true here. Why are you building the capability and then build for that?
Yeah.
So it's an old engineering thing. You build the requirement. Don't just build for the sake of it.
What do you attribute maybe the disconnect that exists between a lot of security teams and the business? Like, what do you attribute that to? Is it that lack of just first principles understanding of what the business needs and how security can enable that? Or is it something else?
Well, I'm actually going to emphasize what you said. I think it's actually the biggest problem in our industry. Mm-hmm. The single biggest problem is the gap between cyber and the business. And speaking from personal experience and mistakes I've made, like big ones, we haven't proven we're business people first. Now, there's a bunch of reasons for it. I'm not blaming anyone, but we come up through the ranks within cyber and we get to the CISO position, and it doesn't take what it took to get here to succeed here. Like, we had to be the smartest cyber person, and we had to be risk, 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 risk. In fact, when you open your mouth at the C-level as a CISO, people know what's going to come out. They know it's not revenue, margin, customer satisfaction, right? You know, it's not employee efficiency. It's none of those things. And so when you do that, when you actually pay attention to other business requirements, when you can sit there and say, we have a risk, I think we should accept the risk in this IT control and instead go hire that person over there in marketing or sales. People turn around and go, wow, you're a business person first. And you start to close that gap. Who are you? What did you do with our CISO, right? But this is important because you also have to bring the business priorities back to the security department, which may change your priority list. It's not all driven by a risk registry. Right? That the risk registry is important and you got to deal with the big stuff. But then you get to a point down that list where it changes. And so to answer your question, it's that we're perceived as hobbyists still, or perceived as techies first, or perceived as security first and only in many cases. And we often revert to type. We have to truly trust our lieutenants and become more social with our peers and more present in the business and go out and see customers. Like, it's not an inside the building thing. If we don't know the pain of the customers in our core business, how are we going to do our jobs properly? Almost the most important thing we can do is to get out to where the pain of the core business's customers are. And I have to emphasize that. And the people who are our customers, how are they using the IT tools in place, for instance, or the physical situation, if you're in manufacturing or if you're in healthcare, you got to get out and watch it happening. You got to go sit in, hip and notwithstanding, in something like the ER or in an ICU, and really understand what the demands are. Because otherwise, how are you going to do your single sign-on policy? I mean, come on, right? So it's not about what we think it's about. Does that put it in context?
It does. Yeah. No, that's interesting.
And we all have to work at that. And I think we could do more getting there to prepare the CISOs, because the burnout rate's high and we're afraid to look like we don't know things. So I actually gave some advice to an interim CISO once whose boss was a CIO and said, Sam, can you coach him? Because he needs more gravitas. And I don't know what to do with that, right? And the thing was, he had a habit of turning up with all the answers. And that meant, hey, it's cyber, I got this, don't bother your head with it. And he never really asked questions. So he was doing two things wrong. He wasn't paying attention to the business, and he wasn't letting other people have a piece of cyber. So I advised him, don't bring a presentation, ask questions, don't tell a thing. He wound up not getting the full-time CISO position because he continued to turn up with a PowerPoint and he continued to tell people cyber. I made the same mistake. By the way, it's not just this guy. I made the exact same mistake with my shortest tenure as a CISO. I kept turning up with the cyber answers and not really paying attention to the non-cyber stuff. Big lesson.
Yeah. What would you have done differently? Like if you went back in time with that job right now, like when you say you would have.
Well, I also didn't culturally really fit with the company, so I probably wouldn't have taken the job. But if I took a job, well, what I did in the next few jobs was I turned up for everything non-cyber. And when things came up for cyber, I would ask people their opinions. And I wouldn't just say, oh, no, everybody knows that the real protocol is KMIP for that, like whatever, you know, key management protocol or something. Mm-hmm. Nope. It was, let's have a business discussion about what we need. And what do you think we should do? And what have you seen work before? And people expecting me to be like, oh, yeah, I'll take care of the certificate management, for instance. It's like, no. How do we, I turn to the COO and go, can we put an ops process in place? Because I don't want to hire someone to do the key management here. Yeah. Rather than say, oh, it's me. Yeah, let me hire another person and have a bigger empire. Mm-mm. And I would talk to the CTO and say, or the CIO in one case, and say, I'm not interested in more people. How do we transition some of the stuff from my team to your team to operationalize it so I can do some of these other things? And they were like, whoa, okay, you're not just trying to get the headcount from me, right?
Yeah, interesting. Okay.
I did the same thing with DevOps. I moved a person over. I said, we need DevSecOps function. I could see the CTO roll his eyes. And I said, so I'm going to transfer two people over if you're up for it. And they were, that's how you build trust, right?
Yeah. That sparked another just sort of topic I'm curious to get your thoughts on, just in terms of maybe what your thought process has been or your strategy has been throughout your career when it comes to navigating like the jobs you want to take, what you want to do, and just like how you've thought about the arc of your career over the last 20, 30 years.
Well, the first thing I'll say is most of it isn't planned. I love when people go, my master plan is to do A, then B. It's like Babe Ruth pointing to the stands and then hitting the ball there. It doesn't work that way. So looking forward, most of my career has been based on two things, maximize potential around things I find interesting and not saying no. Now, a lot of people will tell you, find ways, you know, you've got to say no. You got to push back. But my observation is that there's generally two approaches to things. One is you say no because you've thought what you're going to do for the week. You've thought what you're going to do for the day. You've got your project. You've got your Gantt. You've got your whatever. But if you say no, you're holding it back. You're not innovating. You're not thinking about how to change. Mm-hmm. If you say, let me think about that, and you really do, or if you say, yes, I'll find a way. You know, give me 24 hours to try to factor it in. Or if it's a small task, yeah, I'll do it. I don't know when, but I'll do it. I'll do it at 10 p.m. tonight or whether if the kids go to bed or whatever. You wind up finding better ways to manage your day. You become a better project manager. You become a better leader. You become a better thought leader. Otherwise, I would never have done podcasts. Otherwise, I would never have blogged. I would never have written standards. I would never have gone to meet customers, right? I mean, if you wind up being in the first category, you're the person, you're going to get to go home at 5, and then you're going to say, why do I not get the opportunity to be on a board somewhere? Why do I not get the opportunity to lead an acquisition project? Because you're the guy who says no, right? And if you say, let me find a way, or yeah, if you want to get something done, you give it to a busy person. That's what you do. Right. And there's managers who work by harmony and trying to put order. And then there's the people that are trying to figure out how do you make it happen. So now looking back at my career, that has helped me because there wasn't a master plan. So there were a number of points where opportunities came because of that. Like when I went from docs to QA, or I was in engineering. And when I went to McAfee, I was this chief security architect. Someone said to me, hey, doc, we're doing this .com thing. I think we made like 400K a year in advertising with our website. When I was done with it, it was $330 million a year in subscription revenue. That was in under 3 years, right? If I had said, I did actually say, I don't know what product management is, right? I have no idea what it is. I did actually say that, but I said, okay, I'll try it. And I went out and figured out and got training. And if anybody ever wants to know about that, just Slack me, not Slack me, but send me a LinkedIn. You figure out how to do it, right? Yeah. And I was recruited to go to an enterprise firm, And if I'd said, no, I'm working in the consumer space, I would never have gone on to CA and RSA and so on, right? And, you know, I was originally in network security, but I wound up in endpoint and then identity and then back to network and then back to endpoint and now back to identity and network. So you move around. And that's a much more interesting story than just pointing at the stands.
Right. Yeah, love it. I would love to maybe pivot into how we wrap up every interview here. It's the rapid fire round. So,
all right, I'll try. Oh God, I'm awful at those things. I think too much is the problem, but let's try it. All right.
That's the point. It'll be fun. So I ask a bunch of quick questions. You share whatever comes top of mind.
All right. If something Freudian comes out, we'll erase it, right?
Like, yeah. We can edit. All right. So first one, what's your favorite book?
Of all time? It's either Ursula K. Le Guin's The Left Hand of Darkness or Dune. The one I return to a lot is maybe Jerig by Stephen Bruce. I like fantasy. I like science fiction. I'm reading a great book right now called The Bone Ships. It's
Bone Ships.
Bone, B-O-N-E, ships, S-H-I-P-S. It's just such different world building. The reason I said Ursula K. Le Guin's The Left Hand of Darkness, she's amazing. But she said, when you're truly good science fiction, in the vein of like Isaac Asimov, who said you really change one thing and everything follows from that. But what she said was different. She said, you suspend your disbelief, you move into this world that's been created, and somewhere in there you get yanked back when you realize it's about today. It's not laser beams out in pew pew, which is fun. I mean, it's fun. But when you realize it's a commentary on now, is when you go, ooh. And the only way you could have gotten there was by suspending disbelief, relaxing and getting into this. So it's not escapism. It's the pull back from the escape and then realizing the commentary. And actually, Left Hand of Darkness, when it was written, it's funny. There's a lot of gender in that and gender identity. And it was written quite a while ago. She explored some incredible things in her writing. And the same thing is usually when you're reading, it's a commentary on now if it's good. There you go. Sorry, that was a long answer to a quick question, rapid fire. But yeah, next one.
No, it's interesting. I've got four more books in my Amazon cart now, so we're good. Yeah.
The Bone Ships is what I'm reading right now, and I'm halfway through. Yeah. So if it turns out terrible, I apologize. But yeah, it's so far. I haven't been able to put it down, but yeah.
Cool. What would you change if you could change one thing about the security industry?
As opposed to just like waving a wand and changing a symptom, you want to change some one thing to change. Well, it has to be related to the problem we've been discussing. It has to be related to the gap between us and the business. I really would like to get that translation to the business language better. I would like to get most people lower in the security departments more exposure sooner to business rather than just cyber.
How would you do that?
It's not fluffy.
Follow-up question.
Well, how would I do that? Well, I guess it's not a formal education thing. I think it's probably an apprenticeship or a mentor. It's probably a mentorship and or an internship thing. I mean, we did this with engineers. We brought them into the SOC so they could spend like a quarter in the SOC to really understand what, when we were doing like SIM, come to the SOC and see it, right? Come work in the help desk. We would do this. I think we could do the same thing with security people. We could have them, if not spend all their time there, but pair up and buddy up with some business folks. I mean, the impression is of empty suits and whatnot, but a day in the life of a salesperson is not easy. The high risk, high anxiety, and go and see what the customers actually worry about. In fact, it would help the salespeople in most organizations because you could be the interpreter of what the customer needs if it's security. But I think it's generally good for technical people to get exposed to the real business of wherever they are, regardless of cyber or not.
Yeah, for sure. All right, last one. If you could go back in time and get a drink with your 20-year-old self, what advice would you give him?
Wow. Is this advice or specific things to avoid? Like,
however you interpret the question, whatever you'd want to tell your 20-year-old self most.
Wow. You know, the funny thing is, I don't really have anything to tell him. And I'm going to say that for a few reasons. I might want to verify a few things because human memory is so bad. I might want to go back and ask him some things. That's absolutely. But so I had a teacher who said, we often play this game of going back in time, but you have to go back not with what you know now, because it's not fair. He said, you don't get to relive with what you know now, you know? And I totally get that. Maybe I give him a stock tip or two, by the way. But is that insider telling yourself? Yeah, I think it is. Sorry, Einstein. But I meant that at a time. Anyway, but the other thing is that I really do forgive myself for making mistakes. Like, really. So I try to make the best decision that I can with the data that I have. And I know that I'm going to make imperfect decisions on imperfect data. Decisions are required. And that I'm going to make mistakes. And that's okay. So I don't go back and say, I don't want to second guess him. I don't want to make him afraid to make decisions. I think the only thing that I would say is just, you know, stay the course and whatnot. This is one of those things that you actually reliving it would be different, I think. Yeah. But I have no real regrets because of that attitude for a long time. Yeah. So I don't look back and go, man, you know, when I made that, there's very few points in my life I made a decision where I go, how could I have done that? Because I remember most of those points being like, I'm going to do the best that I can now. And so be it. I also have a principle of really trying to do the right thing, and that helps in every moment. So I know that I didn't have malice when I tried to do something. And it sort of pisses me off when people don't see that in me, but they either know me or they don't.
Yeah. No, I love it. I think that's a very, very healthy outlook. So, well, Sam, this has been awesome, man. Thank you so much
for
taking
the
time to chat with me.
Those questions are pretty deep. And, anyway, I hope this is good for your listeners, and thanks for having me, and love to talk again sometime.